Welcome everybody to the November 2008 session of our International MD Support Group with over 170 affiliates, and we're nearing 3,000 members now around the world. You should have in your hand this month's newsletter, which includes a special feature about sunglasses, including how they can prolong and enhance our vision and what features to look for when it comes to our safety and comfort. Remember, sunglasses aren't just for summertime. People like us need them all year round, and I know some people listening to this presentation, it's summertime for you, so it's especially important for you. The newsletter also makes special mention of our sponsors. As I said, Macular Degeneration Research representatives are here today. Kathleen Honecker and Ed are here today. And the other is MD Foundation. Liz Troernicht is the director of that, both of whom have committed their financial support of the IMDSG through the coming year. Without them, we couldn't continue to offer this outreach totally free to you and your center. If you're thinking about making a holiday donation in return for the services provided by this outreach, please consider either or both of these caring organizations. Your tax-deductible contribution will go wherever you specify, whether that be research or educational outreach, and a gift of any amount will be greatly appreciated by either of the organizations. As a possible option, I might suggest collecting a group donation and sending it in the name of your affiliate. We'll make special mention of that in the newsletter if you'd like to do it that way. Mailing addresses for both of our sponsors can be found on the first page of your newsletter. Now, if I were still working in church music ministry, which I did for over 30 years, this is when I would have the choir sing an inspirational anthem while we pass the collection plate. In the interest of time, however, I'm going to let you take care of that at your own discretion if you'd like, and we're going to move on to introducing our very special guest speaker. Singer, actor, author, writer, producer Tom Sullivan lives and works by Sullivan's Rules. Those were invented by his dad, Porky Sullivan, so young Tommy could play baseball with the neighborhood kids. The rules became the cornerstone by which the adult Tom Sullivan came to live his life, turning any negative into a positive, turning disadvantage into advantage, and playing in every game. Born prematurely, Tom was given too much oxygen in an incubator, and though it saved his life, it did cost him his eyesight. The inconvenience, he calls it, of being blind has never kept him from competing in a world where he realized that to be equal meant that he had to be better. Even though he's had to adapt the rules slightly, he's proven that one needs not be limited by a handicap. He's an excellent golfer. He's a marathon runner, an avid snow skier, an Olympic-class wrestler who was recently inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame, and early in his career, Tom gained national prominence as a recording artist, along with over 50 appearances on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. I think I saw every one of those. He was a special correspondent for ABC's Good Morning America, and he's written and starred in numerous television sitcoms. You might have seen him on Mork and Mindy, WKRP in Cincinnati, Designing Women. He's currently writing and producing films for television and major motion pictures. Tom has also created a series for ESPN titled Superior Beings that is now set to become a series in primetime. He's authored 9 books to date. If You Could See What I Hear is an early biography of Tom's life, which was made into a highly successful major motion picture starring Mark Singer a few years ago. In his latest title, Adventures in Darkness, Tom takes readers through his monumental 11th summer as a blind child. For over 15 years, Tom Sullivan has been one of the most sought-after inspirational speakers on the circuit, and we are very grateful to him for taking the time to speak with us today. We're also very grateful to Ed Huggett, who made friends with him at a conference last year and asked him to come on, and it went from there. Tom, welcome to the IMDSG. Several thousand of us in the low vision and blind community are eagerly anticipating spending this hour with you.
Well, Dan, first of all, I'm incredibly humbled to be part of this and have a chance to talk to folks who clearly have a much harder road than I did as you wrestle with really one of life's most complex elements, the loss of sight at a later point. And I can't express enough how much this means to me to be part of this. Also, this feels like my favorite medium, old radio, doesn't it? I mean, don't you like the radio dramas? And I grew up as a young blind kid in my backyard listening to them all. I mean, from Argyle Sunday to One Man's Family to The Guiding Light, Young Dr. Malone, Pepper Young's Family, Ma Perkins, and then the mysteries, Johnny Dollar and Suspense and The Shadow. Radio was everything for me, and so this really is very much like sharing radio with you, which means I can lie to everybody. I'm actually 30, about 6'4". My hair is still blonde, which is a lot of crap. I'm 61. And so some of the issues that this audience relates to are very much things I'm thinking about. How can I take care of Patty, the woman I've been married to now for 40 years when I'm in my 70s? What happens to a blind person as you get older and the jobs are less and less available? A lot of things that many of you have had to think about and deal with. And I think to maybe bring perspective to some concepts that I want to share, we're going to go back. We're going to go back 61 years to when I was born. In my case, I was 3 months premature, and I was dealing with what was then called retrolental fibroplasia. Great. Now it's called retinopathy of prematurity, but back then it was retrolental fibroplasia. And when I went to the blind school, Perkins, where Helen Keller had gone to school, all the kids, we used to sing, "We've got retrolental fibroplasia, glaucoma and cataracts too. Our friends say that we're blinks, but they know less than what they think, because we've got retrolental fibroplasia." It was a stupid song. But it taught me one of the first lessons that you need to learn when you have disability, and that's to find both the ability and the humor in it all. But that's not where I started. I started 3 months premature, 3 pounds, 4 ounces, dropped down to 2.5 pounds, but made it. My parents brought me home, and about 5 months later, my mother began to notice that something was wrong with my eyes. It's always the mothers. Folks, here's some statistics that I want you to know about, because I want you to grasp the complexity of the way society views many of us who are blind. The national divorce rate in America is about 43%. Among families with blind children today, the divorce rate's well over 70%, which means the stress in raising a blind child, or in your case, the stress of your adjustment to macular and your family's adjustment to macular, is certainly complex, huh? So they brought me home, and my mother began to notice something was wrong with my eyes. I didn't follow the light when she opened the shades to let the sun in. She put a colored mobile above my crib, and I didn't pay attention to it. She would move around the room, and I didn't follow her with my eyes. And so she eventually went to my father, who's someone I think a lot of you would like to have known. My father was born in Ireland, in the village of Kinsale, on the west coast of Ireland. He came to America in the fourth grade, and 2 weeks after they got here, my grandfather died, and my father literally had to leave school and go out and get a job working for the Boston Globe as a runner, a messenger. He did that till he was 18, and then he tried to make a living as a boxer, a prize fighter, which wasn't very useful because he had a glass jaw and he got knocked out 9 times. But he was an undaunted kind of a human being, and it was 1919, and a marvelous thing happened to the Irish in America, Prohibition. They said you couldn't drink. My father made a fortune selling bootleg booze for Joe Kennedy all over New England, and by the time I came along, he owned 9 Irish pubs, and he managed prize fighters. He was Boston's leading bookie. He had an amazing life. I grew up with athletes and fighters and people just on the edge of the law. But all of that is to say, my father was someone who never, ever could accept the idea that I was blind. He used words like, "Tom is sightless, Tom is disabled, Tom is handicapped, Tom is limited." Well, Tom was none of those things. Tom was blind. one of the important elements in accepting the concept of your site as it is today is to be honest with yourselves. I think the thing that I notice most with people, particularly with wet macular, is that so often, right up to the end, right up to the time when the sight is basically gone, you work to live in the world of the sighted, because that's who you are, that's who you've been. I think if I could offer one piece of really tangible advice, it is, don't kid yourselves, and go to work to figure out how to be blind long before it happens. Now look, companies like Allergan, a company I work for, we're getting pretty close, as Ed Huggett will tell you, we're getting pretty close to some pharmacological answers to retinal issues. And I do think there'll come a day not too far in the distant future when maybe we'll get macular under control. But the reality is that's not the way it is now. And so while you have your sight, start to work on things like mobility. Develop the home skills necessary to stay independent. Recognize that if you do that, your lives don't have to really change that much. I mean, think of all the wonder of what you're doing here today. We're online sharing this together. Learning technologies, as Dan has proven, are more than available to those of you with macular. What's going on, for example, in voice speak now, rather than type, if the hands aren't as good because of arthritis or whatever, is remarkable. Dragon 10, the new Dragon voice actuation that's out now, is absolutely state of the art. So the point is, make the decision to invest in being sighted, being blind, before you lose all the vision. So my father came in after he had a Jameson's Irish whiskey on the rocks, and he looked in my eyes with a flashlight, and he said, yeah, I don't know, Marie, something must be wrong. And they took me to a doctor at Mass General Eye and Ear in Boston. The guy's name was Friedrich Virchow, Freddy Virchow, a doctor with the bedside manner of a Hun. This is honestly a true story because my two sisters were present. My sister Jean is 15 years older than I am, so she's 76, and my sister Peg is 8 years older. She's 68, which shows you how often Irish Catholics have sex, but that's a whole other conversation we'll have sometime. But my sister Jean was there, and this guy, Virchow, the doctor, looked at my parents after he examined my eyes, and he said, Mr. and Mrs. Sullivan, your child is blind. Institutionalize him. That's what he said. Lock him up. Put him away someplace where he'll be safe. One of the great problems that you face as folks dealing with macular is the insensitivity so often of your physician. And I'm mentioning that to you because I want to frame this for you. One of the reasons that ophthalmologists particularly are not in tune is because these fellows and ladies are surgeons. They're trained like Olympic athletes. They're trained to win, aren't they? And if they can't, excuse me, if they can't offer you a positive result, then they're like the guy who went for the gold medal and didn't get it. And nothing in their training as residents teach them how to be interactive in the needs of people with limited vision beyond the medical questions. What I've been telling them a lot as I've traveled around the world talking to docs is, look, somebody in your practice needs to know where the rehabilitation programs are in your area. Some need to know about the mobility questions and teaching appropriate home skill and technology, all of it. But that's a war I'm fighting on another front. What I want to say to all of you is that based on what I've learned about the insensitivity of many ophthalmologists, you need to be proactive. The question is, how do you be proactive when you've just faced the devastating loss of a big part of your vision? Can I just say this to everybody? I can't imagine the pain that you've been through. I can't imagine the emptiness and fear that comes as the vision field gets less. I can't begin to understand it, because I was born blind, and being blind from birth, That's the only world I've known. But I do want to say this to you. Nobody wins by living on the sidelines. I have known so many seniors who have astounding courage and, like prize fighters, like my father, get up off the mat and fight the next round because life is still so relevant. There's still so much love to give and share and participate in. And all it takes is the first decision to try. In my case, my parents took me home and they built a fence around my backyard. The idea was to keep me inside the fence and keep the world outside the fence. Down the street from the house where I lived, there was a baseball field. And every day I could hear the sound of kids playing ball down there, the sounds of the bat hitting the ball and the ball popping into people's gloves as they played. And I desperately wanted to be part of the game. My father had given me a Louisville Slugger baseball bat. And I started picking up rocks from the ground and throwing them up in the air and trying to hit them with the bat and announcing myself as if I was Ted Williams playing for the Boston Red Sox. Well, one afternoon, I swung that bat and caught the rock dead center and hit a long fly over my own fence like it was Fenway Park, a home run. And I ran around my yard, and slid into my own make-believe home plate. But there was a little boy there who'd been playing in the real game down the street, and he came by and he looked through the fence and he said, "What's the matter, kid? Are you blind?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, that's a stupid game, and I think you're a stupid kid." And then he started to chant. He sang, "Blindy, blindy, blindy, blindy." I hated that child. I picked up rocks from the ground and threw them at him. He kept moving out of the way. "Blind," I'd throw a rock. "Blind." Eventually, he went away, and I went to the corner of my yard and sat on a tire swing and cried my eyes out. But something wonderful happened, everybody. Something I think needs to happen to every person listening to this broadcast. Because you only have one life, and what you do with it can only be determined by you. No matter how much you're loved by your families, no matter how much you're cared about by your friends, no matter how much commitment there is on behalf of your rehabilitation counselors or your ophthalmologist or optometrist, in the end, the decision has to come down to you. And what I'm suggesting to you is it's never too late to become competitively angry. Not destructive, competitive. To develop that attitude that says, if there's technologies out here, if there's rehab available, if there are friendships to share, if there are home skills to develop, if there is any hope that I can turn my disadvantage into advantage, I'm going to do it. And that brings me to a concept that's absolutely basic to understanding Tom Sullivan. The idea that all disadvantages in this life, no matter how compounded, no matter how graphic, no matter how serious, all disadvantages can be turned into advantages without exception. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to illustrate it in the most graphic story I can tell you. Dan noted that I got involved in wrestling as a boy. It's a contact sport. You know, you grab the other person and throw them on the ground and try to kill them. I lost the first 14 matches in 2 minutes and 23 seconds altogether. I mean, I was awful. The coach we had from Boston was a sarcastic old guy. And when I went out for the 15th match, he said, "Listen, Sullivan," he said, "the kid you're going to compete against is a much better athlete than you are." He said, "Go out and do the best job you can and try not to be dead." Real positive, right? I lost that match. But I realized that all I could do was the best job possible. Hey, folks, that's all you can do with your lives. Channel your energies to do the best job possible. I lost that match. But when I allowed myself to relax and just do the best I could, I won the next 187 in a row, and a world championship and some other things. That's not important. What is the idea of turning disadvantage into advantage. Now, as I told you, I was born with retrolental fibroplasia, 3 months premature, too much oxygen in the incubator. But over the next 20 years, I also developed glaucoma. And for any of you that have had it, you'll never forget the headaches. Eventually, they enucleated my eyes, and mine are prosthetic. You take them out at night like contacts, and you wash them off, and you put them back. So I was competing against a kid from the Soviet Union. The score was 11-3. The Russian was ahead. Every time he knocked me down, it got more and more painful, so I did the only thing I thought made sense. I just reached up and popped out one of the little suckers and dropped it on the mat and said, "Stop, stop." He said, "Why?" I said, "I lost my eye." And the kid looked down and saw it and went, anyway, he threw up on the mat. And in the World Games record book, it still says Sullivan over Asmanov by default. That's turning disadvantage into advantage. And it's possible for everyone. The other thing I want to tell you about is that Virchow was basically condemning me to a life of dependence. When he said to my father, put him someplace where he's going to be safe, he was saying that I was going to be a dependent person. I spent my whole life trying to become independent, right? All the sports you've heard about, all that stuff, be independent. What I have learned is that we are interdependent. And in that interdependence, we come to understand what it really means to be human. I also believe that in every life there are turning points, moments that shape us, define us, frame who we are as people. And I don't want to have this conversation with you without you understanding that Tom Sullivan, this new friend of yours, has had to face some pretty critical turning points. My wife Patty and I have two grown children, our daughter Blythe and our son Tom. When our daughter was 4 years old, we had just come to California because I was trying to seek fame and fortune and make it in the record business. What I want you to understand is that at that time in my life, I felt pretty damn sorry for myself. And I'll bet there's a fair number of you in this audience who feel just the same way. I felt like I had been cheated because I was blind. That's what I felt. See, I had gone to Perkins, where Helen Keller went, as I said, the school for blind kids, and in that school I was the best at everything. Best singer, best athlete, best student, best. But I'd go home on weekends and nobody would play with me in the neighborhood. You see, I was the best at being blind, but the worst at being sighted. When they'd pick up teams, you know, and you'd put your fingers out odd or even, and somebody would say, "You take Jane, and you take Charlie, and you take Joe, and you take Jimmy." We'd get to the last pick, and they'd say, "Well, you take the blind guy." So I was a pretty angry kid. And we came to California, and I was trying to make it in music. It was a June morning, and my wife, Patty, went shopping. My job was to watch our children. Watch our children. The telephone rang, and I answered it, and the guy on the other end was Johnny Carson. He had seen me in a nightclub the night before and was asking if I'd like to do the show. Folks, I got so involved in the conversation, I never heard the sound of the little girl crossing the living room. I never heard my daughter Blythe open the sliding glass door. I never heard her feet on the deck. But I heard the sound of the splash when she fell in the swimming pool. When she fell in the swimming pool. I called her name, Blythe, Blythe. I screamed it, Blythe! No answer. I remember I scrambled outside and fell over chairs and tables and kind of groped to the edge of the pool and rolled into the water, and I realized that the only possibility would be to dive under and grope along the bottom and hope to God, hope to God I'd touch her. And I started to count the seconds, 15, 16, 17, swim the length of the pool, surface at about 25 and scream her name, Blythe, Blythe, dive again, 30, 31, 32, 33, 35, Blythe, Blythe, 35, Blythe, Blythe, no answer. It got to 40, and I came to the surface, and I found that I was now standing in about shoulder-deep water, standing in shoulder-deep water. And I looked up to heaven, and I said, God, isn't this some unbelievable joke? You've given me these two beautiful children. You've let me marry the girl of my dreams. You gave me a Harvard education. I went to the Olympics. I'm out here in California chasing a dream in show business. All of it means nothing, because right now in this water, this child is going to die, and she's going to die because it's my fault, because I'm blind and I hate you and I hate life. And then I started to cry. And I said, look, God, if you'll just give me this one thing, this one moment, I'll live an exemplary life. And then there was a quiet sound. You wouldn't hear it. Not because you couldn't, but because you wouldn't. It was the sound of her air bubbles. And they blipped, blipped, blipped their way to the surface. And I followed them and dove down and found her in about 9 feet of water and brought her up and respirated her. And when she breathed, it sounded like a dove at sunset on a summer night. At that moment, folks, I saw the best and the worst of what it was to be blind. The worst was this child was going to die in the pool, and it was my fault. The best was that I found her. And she's an astounding young woman. So here's the bottom line, everybody. When I'm an old guy and I leave this planet, here's what I wanted to say on the tombstone. I wanted to say, here lies Tom Sullivan, husband, father, author, actor, athlete, humanitarian, community citizen, who, by the way, happens to be blind, who, by the way, happens to be blind. If I can change the label, then my life will have been absolutely, unequivocally worthwhile. And so that's what I want for you. There's nothing more difficult than losing your sight later on in life. Nothing I can think of. But let me frame it this way for you. I'd trade all these achievements for the rainbows you've seen. I'd trade all of it to see my beautiful Patty smile. I'd trade all of it to surf off the California coast with my son. I'd trade all of it to walk on my golf course all alone at sunset, playing shots just because I wanted to, all alone. So don't kid yourselves. I understand what it means to not have sight. I get it. But you can remember what blue is. You know what a sunset's like. What I'm working for here, everybody, is perspective. What I want you to feel is that life offers all of us challenges. Challenges that we find difficult to accept. Challenges that sometimes go beyond us, beyond our scope, beyond our sense of being able to deal with them. But if you wake up in the morning, if you wake up in the morning and you know you have another day to live, the question is, what do you do with that day? No matter what your age, no matter what your circumstance. Most of you have worked hard all of your lives. You've raised your families, and you've done it with a sense of pride in what you do. I don't think that the state of macular degeneration should take away that sense of who you are, your own uniqueness. See, I believe everyone in this life offers something special. There are no two people just like you. God made you unique. And so even as you face macular, I want you to focus on the pride you take in what you can offer life. And I define pride as personal responsibility for individual daily effort because it's required. Pride in what? Pride in being the same person you were prior to the time you lost sight. Because remember, I said, disadvantage can be turned into advantage. Turning points can be overcome. Pride in being people who still can be people who are purposeful. To love your grandchildren or great-grandchildren. To share your knowledge and wisdom with your children and with friends. To participate actively through the use of technologies and the kindness of those you share with, that's still available. It is still of purpose for all of you. And here's the big word. This is the one that I think so often gets lost when life becomes too tough. The word is passion. To be a passionate human being and to bring that passion, no matter what your age or circumstance, to life. What is life worth if it's not worth passion? For me, the cheeseburger I'm going to have when this is over is as important as the run I took this morning on the beach. It's all relative. It's how you engage. Pride in being unique people who are purposeful and passionate. That's the central theme of this message. There is no one like you. You are unique. Disadvantage can be turned into advantage. Human beings need to understand the difference between dependence, independence, and interdependence. All of us face turning points that challenge our character, and Dr. King was right when he said, we're not measured by the color of our skins, but by the content of our character. And each of us can engage in living lives with pride in being people who are purposeful and I wish you could all say it out loud. In fact, let's do that. I can't hear you, but 1, 2, 3, passionate. Passionate to live lives as caring, loving, passionate human beings.